Hello everybody, this is just a quick video to round up all the stuff that we used when we realised that Trump was going to be cycled in this time. It's been quite a controversial opinion. We were very stringent about it on the stream on Monday on the 4th, but I would like to show people what I would consider the indicator minerals. No matter what the polling is saying, you can get some form of revealed preference from what the elites are doing, what the actual power brokers are doing, and when you recognize who the power brokers are, you can start to predict the political future. But here, in a very nuts and bolts way, is how we knew that Trump was coming. The first big tip-off was that the billionaire class had become more comfortable with him. If we go to an article here from Politico, this is from back in January of this year, and it is in reference to the Davos event that took place. It's entitled Trump's Ghost Stalks Davos, and it's very interesting when it gets down to this section here called Preparing for a Trump World. As some of the most influential decision makers, from politicians like French President Emmanuel Macron and China's Li Qiang, to central bankers and corporate bigwigs like Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan Chase and BlackRock's Larry Fink, come together to do business and talk strategy this week. November's election in the US looms large over the international relations. And it goes on to say that really all of these people have become relatively comfortable with the idea of a Trump future. There's a few articles that we've used in the past, we've used this before, but Trump's presence and the elite's almost passe attitude towards it is something that they had exhibited before this happened. Even outside of the visible billionaire class supporters like Elon Musk, of course, and there's Peter Thiel in the mix there as well, you had this kind of tacit stepping back, at least, from the Democrat cause from a lot of other billionaires. I mean, for Christ's sake, we ended up with Libertarian Zuckerberg. I think Libertarian Zuckerberg, as I put in the image here, is the biggest indicator. When I saw that, I was extremely certain that we were getting Trump. And the reason that they've chosen Trump in this way, the billionaire class, is that in a very genuine sense, the legacy power faction that rammed through their candidate and their agenda last time committed a cardinal sin. They were incompetent at delivering the consensus will of the elite, especially angering Zionist interests. They have also hit people in their wallets in a meaningful way via their incompetence. Again, you've got Peter Thiel, who was quite vocal about his backing of J.D. Vance. And then, of course, you have Elon Musk's bet on Trump has paid off spectacularly. The Tesla chief's $130 million investment has already repaid itself several times over, and now he has the president's ear. It's very clear that Donald Trump has some pull with the billionaire class, and at the very least has allowed them to step out of his way. The biggest upshot of this, and what is meant, is that parts of the quote-unquote serious media, at the behest of their billionaire paymasters, have been instructed to feign neutrality, proving that activist journalists are subordinate to the moneyed interests and power. Jeff Bezos can, at any point, yank the chain of the Post's editors, of individual writers, and say no. This is my paper. I own it. Are you hell endorsing that Kamala Harris woman? I mean, look at this. You've got Jeff Bezos instructing the Post not to endorse. You've got the Los Angeles Times that was felt slighted by Kamala Harris for not giving them a proper interview, chose not to endorse. You've got, as we talked about previously, Jeff Bezos tells the Washington Post editors to hire more conservatives as 10% of readers cancel subscription. You have the billionaire class coming out and saying, look, we need to pander to these people too. And that's very, very powerful. And the neutrality and the lack of enthusiasm for the left that the billionaire class kind of post-war usually encapsulates, you know, the activist billionaire, the do-gooder billionaire, the good guy billionaire, is conspicuously absent from this campaign, especially when it comes to, quite literally, the richest people in the world. These people are more in power and are much more in touch with tastemakers than pollsters are. The second point I want to talk about was the fact that a lot of this has been narrative. The entire pull supposedly behind Kamala Harris has been narrative. The problem that the US political elites faced, and here's a Financial Times article that's behind a paywall suddenly, excuse me for that, but how bad are Joe Biden's post-debate numbers? This is an article from a while ago. But the debate and the narrative around the fact that Joe Biden really was an empty chair threatened to destroy the political project in its entirety, because it would call attention to the kayfabe of politics, as Trump would simply breeze past him. He had become literally stale, making some people question Donald Trump's insurgent kind of credentials. The hilarious toss-up narrative about polls, drawn attention to by arch pollster Nate Silver himself, were a deliberate function of a hedge against a wrong answer in the polling industry that internally knows it depends on which candidate the permanent elite choose and how much fraud there is administered. That I'll not go over the numbers. I'll probably do another video about that. The numbers are hilarious. They've gone back to normal. It's a very good signal about what happened in 2020. But surveying the public doesn't show you which candidate the elite won. And therefore, you have this situation where you have pollsters who are deliberately calling it as a toss-up to not embarrass themselves. They are hedging because they quite simply are throwing their hands up and go, well, it depends who the elite actually want. And I think they know that internally, and this is a signal that they know that internally. There was all of this hedging and, you know, ultra close election. Harris takes the lead. Harris is a threat. You know, the polls say Harris. And it was all wrong, obviously, now. But it benefits the pundit class to try and make the election look closer and much more exciting. It allows the temperature of politics to be higher. It injects people with more energy. And really, it is in the interests of the pollsters to call this close election for both narrative reasons and for reputational reasons. She had to be made a credible bad guy. Again, Nate Silver says Harris now has slight advantage over Trump, despite him coming out and saying that a lot of the polls were bullshit. Kamala had to be more credible because Biden literally got stale. We saw her proclaimed as wildly popular and suddenly ahead in opinion polls. But she had a almost deliberately off-putting campaign. People who bought into the Brat Summer, for example, is Kamala dancing to victory? People who bought into this idea back in August, that Kamala Harris has suddenly become popular, were simply buying into hyper-reality. What they were doing was selling their jobber. They had to sell her as credible or no one would pay attention. Then unreality took hold, and this hyper-real narrative of a knife-edge election became self-perpetuating. The idea was set back in August, it'll be close. And again, it's partially a hedge by the polling industry, it's partially an attempt by political elites to forestall the inevitable and keep donations flowing as well, I would say. But it's also an indicator that the political music was a bit strange, because we were being told that this woman was popular, but really she is portrayed as smelly, low status, as it were. You have to be able to listen to the political music. Here's somebody who is a neocon, really, an official Twitter neocon. Bella Varstein, 85,000 followers. What she said about Harris was, Harris should have picked Shapiro as VP. He'd have brought balance to the ticket, but instead they caved to vocal anti-Semitic fringe that didn't vote for them anyway. The sides and the factions are built up that Trump and the neocons he surrounds himself with, the Zionist interests he surrounds himself with, are the good guys. They're the strong guys, and they have owned the smelly, stupid, dancing leftists. And really, when you look at Kamala Harris, in retrospect, if you look at the Republican sweep that's happened, she just looks like a joke candidate. She just looks like somebody who was meant to lose. And when you look at the revealed preference, there is a rhythmic thrum in the media towards Trump and towards this idea of this narrative arc of him winning and this being a God, yeah, she's such a jobber. And this being something of utility, because there is utility in a Trump win. Here we have, again, we use the spectator. This is Brandon O'Neill again, the spiked alum of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He's a revolutionary communist, Trotskyite conservative, but we don't talk about that incongruity when we talk about the supposed right-wing press. But Donald Trump and the Revenge of the Deplorables. This is from today. And this is the narrative arc. This will be the end of Trust the Plan. This will vindicate in their minds a lot of conspiraboomers who thought that Trump was still in charge. It brings a swathe of Americans back into the mainstream political system by having it demonstrated that democracy, you know, that it's bigger than the steel. American democracy has worked despite it being clearly subject to the whims of elites. The other one, and we've talked about this often, is quite simply that the Israeli wagging of the dog becomes easier with a Donald Trump in charge. He's no secret. It's no secret that he's an ally of Benjamin Netanyahu, of the more ultra-Zionist faction. He's somebody who constantly praises Israel. If you don't believe me, here he is in his own words.
We have to get the people of our country, of this country, to love Israel more. I have to tell you that. We have to do it. We have to get them to love Israel more because you have people that are Jewish people that are great people. They don't love Israel enough. You know that. You know that.
Oh, there we go. I don't think you get much more clear cut than that. He is the tacitly pro-Israel candidate. And as is Mike J.D. Vance. Sorry, I almost said Mike Pence there, as is J.D. Vance. We've read this article before, but Trump VP pick J.D. Vance aims to balance Israel support with America First mantra. He is very much somebody who will apologize for saying America First in certain company if they get asked of why, if they get asked why it doesn't mean Israel First. And that is one of the major criticisms. And again, that has been trying to be jacketed as smelly and leftist and, you know, as a bad criticism, but it's very apparent that this is an ethno-religious carve-out that the Trump administration comes with. Another part of the utility of a Trump win is, again, here's the Financial Times. It seems to have shoved up its paywall since I loaded these. But Donald Trump's betrayal of Ukraine. The betrayal narrative is coming to the fore. Here is basically part a UK think tank about military stuff. RUSI. I'm not actually sure what that stands for anymore, but the impending betrayal of Ukraine. Ukraine faces a precarious future amid waning Western support. The immediate peril comes from the 2024 US presidential election, but the fundamental problem has been the failure of Europe to commit to defeat of Putin's invasion. This gives them a very easy narrative out when it comes to Ukraine. It gives them possibly one of the easiest narrative outs. That no, we didn't lose the Ukraine war materially. Donald Trump betrayed us with his isolationist foreign policy. It's very, very obvious the script kind of writes itself. Another factor that we saw really is that, you know, this is Sloptober after all. We are talking about election stuff and we'll be talking a little bit about betting markets and stuff here. But money does talk. A lot of the poly market stuff I think was overblown, but the betting odds in the UK and Europe, where you can very freely bet on these at places like Betfred or Skybet or anywhere you bet on a horse, Trump was always in charge. Trump was always the front runner. It was always predicting a Trump win, and that is another piece of revealed preference, that the money markets and Mudeng apparently, but the money markets were much better than the polling in predicting who would win and predicting such a strong sweep. I mean, a lot of people didn't bet that Trump would win the popular vote. There was an outside chance of that. I thought the popular vote would be something of a tie, but I think the specifics of electoral politics, since electoral politics isn't real, it is merely the visible machinations of the will of the elite class. Because electoral politics isn't real, I don't get into that kind of detail because there's no point. It's like getting into really, really autistic detail about fictional things. I'm not really into that, as it were. But again, opinion polls have Harris and Trump locked in a tight race. Gambling polls say otherwise, with a lot of derision of the betting markets. And you can't sometimes trust speculation, but all of the markets, especially the markets that are set by, you know, the bookies aren't stupid. And the bookies, with some rare exceptions of just massive shifts of volume, will try and protect themselves if they think there's going to be some sort of miscalculation. So when people's money's on the line, and not just billionaires' monies, but, you know, real people's monies on the line, you start to see the reveal preference take place. Also, financial markets. The financial markets are betting on a Trump victory. I posted something about Palantir earlier. I won't get that one back up. This is becoming a roundup as it is. But again, the financial markets where people's money were acting like Trump had already won, in the same way that trades happened for 9/11 before 9/11 happened. But that's a different one. It is the same principle, though. A lot of people have advanced knowledge and they use it to profit. And if you see market movements that suggest a presidential outcome, it makes that outcome more likely, because the people who are in the know in politics tend to make these outrageous insider trades and never get called up on it. So yes, money does talk. And where people put their money is usually where the smart money is, where the actual money is. But the way we did it really is keeping calm and remembering our training. Elections aren't real. American elections especially aren't real. And visible politicians are not necessarily the people who are in power. And if you can recognize the direction that the power brokers are moving, and you remember that all politics happens top down, there is no bottom up, you cannot actually wag the political dog, your vote is not actually counted, you are not contributing to the system, that is a delusion. You can only do what you do yourself directly, otherwise you surrender to magical thinking. Very, very, very basic within this framework. But when you stay calm and remember your training and you think, well, if this isn't real, ignore all the polling, ignore all the narratives, ignore the hyper-reality, what are the power brokers saying? What does the political music sound like? How are these people being sold to us? Is somebody a face or a heel? And it was very clear, just even from, it's a really kind of waffly and woolly way to talk about it, but the political music, the background noise, how something feels, how it looks, the tone of it, the intangible quality of it, was again that Kamala Harris was not a credible candidate. And that alone, really, it felt like Trump was meant to win. It felt narratively like Trump would win. And because the news doesn't reflect reality, it reflects a narrative, they had to ratchet up the tension. And that is part of why we saw this panic. And I think people who panicked about it and believed the whole Kamala summer thing were retarded. I think this was as foregone a conclusion in terms of an election as Keir Starmer's election was. I know a lot of people, you're only being so confident now, but look at our video. Look at our stream, the day before. Trump will win. We were very categorical about this. We've not hedged our bets. We've not kind of ummed and ahed and looked at both sides. We've been very solid on this for years. But we've been so solid on this because there is a great body of evidence that you could tap into that showed you ahead of time what was likely to happen in the political future. And if you're able to tap into that information, then it's not that difficult. It really isn't that difficult to see these things if you're listening. Anyway, that's enough gloating from me. I'll let you guys go. All I would say is do leave a comment, do interact with the videos. It does help a lot. But I will see you guys next time. Donation links down below and all that. Super chat, super stickers, super thanks. Please, YouTube doesn't give us very much money. I'll talk to you guys again. Goodbye.